Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mets are amazing, 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 amazing.
There's a fly ball hit out to left. Waiting is Jones. The Mets are the world champions.
Here's the 1-2 pitch. Check him out. Seaver has 19 strikeouts.
Swung on, hit on the ground towards first.
Robin Ventura, the Mets win 4-3. There will be a game 6.
And it's a deep to left center. Andrew Jones on the run. This one has a chance. Home run! Mike Piazza, and the Mets lead 3-2.
To left field, Floyd. And after running roughshod over the National League, the Mets have a title to show for it. 2006 National League East champions.
Here's the payoff pitch from Familia to Fowler on the way. And it's in there, strike three called. The Mets win the pennant. The New York Mets have won the National League pennant. Put it in the books.
It's an end of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, November the 18th. 2018. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check out the show all the time over at our friends, MetsMemorizedOnline.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you can get the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you can leave me a review on iTunes, it'd be greatly appreciated. Hope everybody's doing well. Holiday week coming up, and figured to get a podcast in here before the Thanksgiving holiday. And provided that no big news drops over the holiday weekend, this will probably be our podcast for the week. And it's a good one. I had a chance earlier today to catch up with a former ESPN columnist. You saw him over at FoxSport.com, SB Nation. He's got about 7 books out. Just recently came out with a book called Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game, Rob Nyer. And we'll talk to Rob about a number of things, and I think it's pretty appropriate the same week that Jacob deGrom won the Cy Young that we have Rob basically breaking down a modern baseball game, a September 2017 baseball game, and while he's watching the game, essentially write about different topics about the modern game. This isn't the first time this has been done. Keith Hernandez did something similar, broke down a game very technically from a baseball former player's point of view back in the early 90s. I think it was called Pure Baseball. I have it somewhere in my bookshelf that's right behind me right now. And then there was a Dan Ockrent book back in the early 80s called 9 Innings, which I believe it was the Orioles and the Brewers, and actually a great podcast called Baseball by the Book, which dives into different baseball books. And if you haven't subscribed to it, you should. Some really good work being done over there. Had Dan Ockrent on probably about 6 months ago, around that time. So it wasn't too long ago that that book was revisited many, many years later. So Rob Nyer will be joining us, and we'll get into some of the new topics that are around modern baseball. Bullpenning, the shift, quality of play. Is the DeGrom Cy Young basically the cherry on top of even the mainstream writers and mainstream fans admitting that wins is a thing of the past because of the way that the game is played, the randomness of teams scoring, and how much a starting pitcher, or any pitcher for that matter, has control over the one-loss record. So, you know, we'll dive all into that with Rob. Of course, the big news, and it's been a slow start to the offseason, not really tons of rumors. I think right now the biggest news you have is, and pretty much when I set up the offseason in my last podcast, the Mets are at least, you know, if you listen to Jeff Wilpon, you listen to Brody Van Wagenen, you listen to Mickey Callaway, a couple of different things. You know, number one, it sounds like they're going to try to take whatever budget they have and really address the glaring needs of this high 70s, probably, and I think it was even Jeff Wilpon said, advanced metrics have them as a low 80s win team, and try to address those needs rather than putting all their money into winning the offseason and getting themselves a Harper or a Machado, which, look, those aren't going to hurt you, those kind of moves, but I broke it down. I broke down the tax. I broke down the payroll. To be able to invest $30 to $40 million in one player, I think every team has to think long and hard before they do that. And I suspect that teams that those players will wind up on are going to be very similar to what Alex Rodriguez did in 2001 when he signed with the last place team that or a team, Texas, that was good, but had some pitching issues and had some other needs, and then he winds up going out to Texas and they finish in last place. So it really didn't address what that team needed to get themselves back into the postseason, a team that had won some divisions but couldn't get past the Yankees. So Mets are going to go more in the direction of looking at the bullpen, center field, catcher, maybe second base. I mean, maybe Jeff McNeil moves over to third, or maybe they put Jeff McNeil in a super sub situation. We'll see, but I am okay with that. I know that's not sexy, and I have a feeling that's going to be a big thing this offseason. I think the fans, they're going to want to see a sexy move, and it goes back to what I said in the podcast to set off this offseason. It's not about winning the offseason back page. It's about building the right team, and you know, I wouldn't trade a Syndergaard. I wouldn't just make a move to get a back page, to get a little bit of buzz on a cold December day or a cold January day. Because by the time the season starts and you're in the middle of May, that wears off and that's a long memory. And really nobody cares. So, you know, that's the direction it appears the Mets are going. I think it'll be interesting to see. And I think it is a direction that can yield a team that could compete for a playoff spot and maybe a division next year. But way too soon to talk about that. As for DeGrom winning the Cy Young, I mean, look, I was wrong. Back in August, you guys remember I said that he didn't have the storyline to get the award, that the win-loss record, although it has been diminished, would bite him. And in a lot of ways, I think it helped him, which actually the narrative's twisted towards DeGrom. And I know some people are going to say, well, sure, you're trying to defend your position back in the middle of the summer. But, you know, look, Max Scherzer has won the award before, and metrically, there was a difference. DeGrom was better, but it's not this huge difference. And in Aaron Nola, I know the Phillies faded down the stretch. He's not too far off either. Now, DeGrom is better, without a doubt, but I felt that if Nola had pitched in a pennant race and had pitched big games down the stretch, that would give him a bump. And Scherzer, he's won it before. He's great. I mean, he's got name recognition. And I think that does help, and that does count for some of the voters. But it's almost like the lack of wins, how good DeGrom was pitching and how little he was getting out of it, started to play nationally. And I don't want to say got him the sympathy vote, but really put him on a spotlight with a lot of the writers where, you know, they essentially were like, hey, we can't overlook a guy that has pitched this well. And in context of Mets history, this is the fourth, if you believe in wins above replacement, this is the fourth best performance. And I'm using Baseball Reference for this, behind Gooden's 85 and two of Seaver's seasons, 73 and 71. 73, of course, is when he won the Cy Young Award and the Mets went to the World Series against Oakland. And it's a shade better than Matlock, who also had a not-so-great record in 1974, a 13-15 record. So, you know, DeGrom is right up there in the pantheon with some really great names. And again, this is better than Johan Santana's 2008, Pedro Martinez's 2005, and some other great Mets pitchers like, you know, Frank Viola's 1990, Al Leiter, who had a great 1998, so, you know, so on and so forth. Even R.A. much better than R.A. Dickey's Cy Young season, which was the last player, Mets pitcher, to win a Cy Young Award. Now, if you want to just do a quick fun debate, is it better than Gooden's 85? No, and I'll tell you why. If you really want to have some fun, if you may remember this if you were old enough and invested in that pennant race, but Gooden went into September and gave up in 53 September innings in a pennant race, a very tight pennant race. The Mets wound up winning 98 games and losing the division by 3 games. That tells you how competitive it was with the Cardinals. Gooden gave up 2 earned runs in 53 innings, and those 2 earned runs came the last start of the season for him, October 2nd, when it was already decided. the division had already been decided. So think about that. Gooden went out in the heat of a pennant race against teams like the Cardinals, and I think there was a start in L.A. against the Dodgers. Chicago and Wrigley Field, places that, you know, no matter what the team's record, and certainly the Dodgers and the Cardinals, those were the two teams that faced off in the playoffs, but no matter what the team's record, these are really tough places to play and to pitch well against some good teams, especially the Cardinals, who were a team that was the antithesis of what you see today, you know, slapping the ball all over the ball yard, stealing bases, speed, putting a lot of pressure on a pitcher. And Gooden was that dominant in a pennant race, and you know what? It's nothing against DeGrom. You got to give that, over him. Now, as far as Seaver 73, Seaver 71, I wasn't around to see that. Certainly those pennant races, 73 specifically, yielded a playoff spot, and I'm sure Seaver pitched some really big games down the stretch. But look, you have to look at it in totality, and it's such a, it's six of one, half dozen of the other. You know, DeGrom may have just put in the second best pitching performance in Mets history, in a season that, unfortunately, if he was with a team like the 2015 team, I think there'd be more of a buzz about this debate about how good he is. And I don't think it has anything to do with a one-loss record. So we'll take a quick break. Let's get to it. Rob Neyer, he has a lot to talk about. We'll get to this whole one-loss thing, the wins, the Cy Young, and tons of other modern topics as he talks about the modern baseball game from his lens. Managers, the impact of managers, shifts, the quality of the game, bullpenning, and a ton of other things that are part of this modern baseball, which just 10 years ago would also almost look like you were watching a game from another planet sometimes if you go out there to the ballpark. So let's take a quick break. When we return, Rob Neyer, former columnist at ESPN, author of the book Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game, will be joining us. We'll be back right after this.
How would you encapsulate what you were able to do this year?
Looking back, I always said that there were a couple starts in previous years that I could look back, and if I could find a way to eliminate those, that I feel like it would kind of take me to the next level. And, I was able to do that this year. I didn't really have those starts that I let get out of hand, and looking at how those had happened in the past, it was out of frustration and letting the game speed up on me. I really tried, with runners on, I tried to slow it down, go at my pace, and really concentrate and focus on the pitch I was going to throw next, and just try to execute it and then, go from there. And that seemed to work out for me. So, hopefully, it can keep getting better.
We're back, and joining me, a longtime columnist, you guys remember from ESPN, SB Nation, a bunch of places. He's got his seventh book that just came out about a month ago, Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. It's by Harper. It's Rob Neyer. And Rob, long time, thanks for coming on. And I'm going to tell you a quick story. I don't know if you remember, but when I started writing, blogging, radio, whatever you want to call it, about a decade ago, one of the first national attention, if you want to call it, I got was when you were at ESPN and we were debating Mark Teixeira and Joe Mauer for the MVP. And it was fun. You were real cool about it. And I learned a lot. And it's been a while, so it's a pleasure to finally get you on the show. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And I do remember that. It was fun. And one of the fantastic things about that part of my career, especially when I was at that bit at the end, toward the end of my time at ESPN, was I had a great chance to feature other people's work, that was incredibly rewarding. It's probably the best thing about my career is all the chances I had when people still looked at link dumps, to say, hey, here's this other thing happening over here. You guys should check it out. And that's kind of gone away out there in the real world for the most part. But there were a few years there when you could really make a difference, and that was a lot of fun.
No, absolutely. And that was really, as the internet was exploding and blogs, the beginning of this debate analytics versus scouting and all the stuff that right now is pretty much passe. In your book, and I know this has been done before, I mean, Keith Hernandez wrote a book about 20 years ago looking at a game through nine innings. He actually did an American League and National League game back at that time. It was a book called Nine Innings many years ago in the mid-80s. And yours is a look at the modern game. So I'm assuming you got inspiration from some of the prior versions of this. And I'm curious, you know, end of the year, September, sometimes you don't get the greatest baseball. It's an interesting project and an interesting time of the year back in 2017 that you took this on. So walk the listeners a little bit through, you know, the genesis of this and why you chose this topic in this format.
Well, I wish I could take any credit for the format. But you mentioned the other books. I was a huge fan of Nine Innings when it came out back in the 1980s. It was one of the formative books for me. It came out in 1985. So I was in college, had already been reading Bill James and was always looking for another, for more great baseball reading. And Nine Innings, I just tore through it. I probably read it two or three times. Being a part of that legacy or that tradition was attractive to me. But this book wasn't my book, wasn't my idea. And an editor came to me said, I'd love someone to write a modern day version of Nine Innings, which, I mean, has been. When we were having this conversation, it had been 32 years, basically. And I think you might be the person to write it. And having been such a fan of that book and other books like it, it was attractive to me, the idea of trying to do that, tell the story of baseball as a whole through the lens or the prism of one game. And then the game itself, I also didn't choose. I assumed that once we'd agreed that to do the book, I came up with an outline of things I would like to write about. And once we'd agreed to do the book together, my editor and I, my assumption was that I would actually go to the ballpark, watch a few games, choose one of those, and write about it. While all this was happening, it was the middle of September, or even might have even been late September, in 2017. So my assumption was, well, if this book's going to come out next year, I need to get up to Safeco Field in Seattle this weekend and see all three games and hope that one of those is worth writing about. But my editor quickly disabused me of that notion. He thought we needed to have a larger selection of games to choose from. And I agreed with him ultimately. So instead of me going to the game, he chose a game that would be fun to write about, contain at least most of the elements, most of the themes we wanted to hit on, or I wanted to hit on, and then just watch that game over and over again and listen to all the different audio feeds that were available. And that's something that Dan Okren didn't have back in 1982, when that's the game he wrote about actually happened in 1982. He was at the ballpark, which is great, but I got to watch the game over and over again thanks to the wonders of the MLB at bat, or whatever the TV version is of that, and listen to all the different audio feeds. So that's sort of how it all came together. And then it was just a matter of watching the game, listening to the different feeds, and hitting all the high points, or almost all of them.
Rob Nyer joining us at Rob Nyer on Twitter. Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. Great book. Check it out. And what's cool about it, everyone, is that, you know, as Rob is watching the game, he's going into different topics. And actually this week, talking to you made a ton of sense because, and it's New York topical, I get, but Jacob deGrom wins the Cy Young. And I mean, the team has a losing record with his starts. He wins 10 games. Now, I know, it's, you know, 13 wins with Fernando Valenzuela and King Felix. That's low win totals have been Cy Young Award winners before. But it really, a lot of the concepts, and I'm sure some of the concepts that are rather new that you talk about in this book, I almost feel like are coming to fruition. I have to tell you, Rob, back in August, when everyone was talking about DeGrom for the Cy Young, I told everyone, it's not going to happen.
He doesn't have a story. He's not Scherzer with the history. Nola, if the Phillies win a division and has big starts, those are the stories or the narratives, so to speak, that are going to get the play. And I couldn't be more wrong than that. In a lot of ways, he created a narrative with the losing or the no decisions or the team losing. So it's almost full circle. Here you are talking about modern concepts, and we're talking the week that DeGrom wins the Cy Young.
Yeah, and it's a great point you make about the story, because you're right. If without that storyline, maybe he wouldn't have done quite as well. I think he probably still wins because his victory was so overwhelming. I think didn't everybody except one voter have him first? I mean,
sure.
I know it was,
yeah.
And we've steadily seen over the last, I don't know what it is, 6 or 8 years, an erosion of the idea that a Cy Young winner has to have a great record. Because you mentioned Felix Hernandez, I think when Zach Greinke won his with the Royals, I think he won maybe 15 or 16 games, which seemed like a very small number at that time. And that it's just sort of been, now what would happen if a pitcher went 5-19 or something? Nolan Ryan 1 year was probably the best pitcher in baseball with the Astros, but he went, I think it was 7-16 or something like that, and didn't come close. Could a 7-16 pitcher win this? I don't know. Maybe we're probably moving toward the point, at least, where a pitcher could win with a record like that. And I think it's a positive development. Obviously, I mean, people like me have been advocating for this sort of thing for a long, long time. And there's also, you know, the fact that very few pitchers win 20 games anymore because of the way the game has evolved. I think that, in a sense, devalues wins. Now it isn't expected that a great pitcher used to be. In the old days, you just assumed that a great pitcher would win 20 games or at least could win 20 games. I mean, he did a few times, of course, but Warren Spahn won 20 games, it seemed like, every single year. You just expected that of great pitchers. But when it becomes a thing, something you don't expect from a great pitcher, well, it's hard to hold the Cy Young winner up to that standard. And I think that the very idea of wins, and Brian Kenny's played his part, of course, and as others have, the win itself has become devalued as a stat for individual pitchers, and that's, of course, now most evident in the Cy Young balloting that we've seen. DeGrom finished, 10-9 this season? Is that right?
Yep, with a 1.70 ERA. Yeah,
you know,
a lot of good.
Will we see another 10-win starting pitcher win the Cy Young Award in the next 5 or 10 years? Maybe. We'll see.
Maybe.
But as the wins for starting pitchers continue to sort of ratchet downward, we're going to see more and more pitchers have great seasons with 9, 10, 11, 12 wins, no question. And I would assume that some of those guys will win Cy Young Awards. So it's interesting.
And they might throw it out.
I don't think it's the – pardon me?
They might start throwing wins out. I mean, think about it. On the scoreboard now, you got advanced analytics. Is there going to be a day not too far in the future where you'll see ERA and advanced metrics and maybe FIP and things like that? And agents, I'm sure, always looking to make money will turn. And I know arbitration is still a bit archaic, but it's evolving and say, hey, doesn't matter even if you're 15-1. Steve Traxel won 15 games in 2006 for the Mets, and he had an ERA over 5, and his peripherals were awful. So, you know, it kind of goes back to we may be heading that direction.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that they will largely be thrown out. More and more people just won't bother mentioning the wins and losses. And I don't think wins and losses is going to have a single impact, even the tiniest impact on DeGrom's next contract, nor should it. But I think that it'd be interesting. Someday someone will write a story of it about all this, and it'll be interesting to see how much play Brian Kenny gets, because of course his kill the win tag, which he stuck with for a while on Twitter, and of course talked about on TV all the time. A lot of people sort of scoffed, but I think we're seeing it now. I think he has had an impact on the popular discussion.
Rob Nyer joining me. You know, I when I saw your book come out, I was thinking of my experience. I was at Citi Field in September, Mets Phillies, and I sat behind home plate, 300 section, good view. And I'm looking at the game, and I see the shifts and I see the wild defenses and I see the bullpenning going on around the league. And, you know, you watch a broadcast now and they could get all the metrics down to exactly where these guys hit. I remember talking to Kevin Long about 5 or 6 years ago and say, it's going to get harder to hit if they could just put the defense exactly where these guys are hitting it. And I was wondering, as you're watching this game and you've been an early pioneer of analytics, do you ever take a step back like I did that night and just say, this game is so different from 10 years ago. This game is so different. Forget about it. If I'm at Shea Stadium 30 years ago, Yankee Stadium 30 years ago, and someone told me what I'd be watching, I wouldn't believe it. It's just kind of amazing. If you just watch the game and take a step back outside of yourself for a minute and look at what you see, I don't even know if anybody, even the most progressive baseball mind, could have predicted that they'd be watching what they're watching in some cases.
I think it's yes. I would agree that it never occurred to me how things would wind up. Very few of us are capable of accurately predicting the future, and this is true in all walks of life, not just baseball. I've become significantly more humble over the years, to the point where and skeptical. And when I see people trying to, you know, saying that they know what's going to happen 6 months, a year, 2 years from now, whether it's baseball or politics or whatever it might be, I just sort of shake my head and think to myself how difficult it is to know what's going to happen. I never really spent much, if any, time, say 20 years ago, trying to predict what the game would look like in 2018. I think if you had asked me at that time, I would have said, well, the game will be smarter than it is now. People will use analytics. Well, we didn't call it that back then, but they'll use the numbers more and smarter than they do now. But specifically speaking, no, I wouldn't have guessed that we would see as many shifts as we see now. I wouldn't have guessed that we would have so many pitchers throwing 100 miles an hour. I wouldn't have guessed I don't remember anyone even mentioning the possibility of what we now call StatCast technology, where everything is tracked precisely and hitters know exactly what their swing path is, their launch angle. I'm sure there were people talking about these things, but I don't remember hearing about it. I don't remember reading about it. I certainly didn't talk about it. I just thought everything everything would get smarter. And here's the biggest miss, I think, for me and a lot of people. Because we perceived the game as proceeding illogically, because we grew up reading Bill James, perhaps, and spent so much time focusing on what teams and managers were doing incorrectly, at least by our lights, we were offended by that, or I was, somewhat, and wanted to see people be smarter. Well, they are a lot smarter now. What we didn't realize is that the game would, at least in some regards, become not more interesting, but less interesting and less entertaining. And that possibility was not remotely on my radar 20, even 10 years ago. But that, in fact, in my opinion, is what has happened.
Well, you know, it's interesting you brought that up, because you grew up a Royals fan. I know you're a journalist now, so the fandom is not the priority. But I think I was doing some research on your book, that, you know, one of the things which makes you, I think you had a Royals blog, is that you were so logical about where the team is going. And I think it ties into anyone's fandom. And I'll say personally, look, I grew up a Mets fan, and I try to be as objective as possible when I talk about that team, and I've covered New York baseball. But when you know kind of where things are going, and maybe this is the fans have become smarter, it ties into attendance, it ties into passion, it's hard to believe. Like, the hope you had as a kid that, you know, yeah, the 94 Mets stink, but you know what? If this goes right, this goes right, this goes right, this goes right, you know, they could win, and you would have that wonder. And honestly, and I see kids on blogs and commenters, and they're probably in high school, They're not going to ever have that because they have all the numbers that indicate why it shouldn't go wrong. And you basically you said about the negativity and about, you know, maybe you're looking at it from a prism of what can't be done. It is an interesting shift in mindset. And it does take away some of the fun, but I guess it is a different type of fun now or a different type of way of rooting for the team in some respects.
That's right. It is a different type of fun. I think, and you're right, it's hard for me to relate to that fan that I was, say, 20 years ago. I partly because I'm not as invested in the Royals, excuse me, for various reasons, I suppose, and partly just because I have been doing this for a while, but I tend to enjoy the game, baseball, just as baseball, regardless of who the teams are. And there are probably a couple teams I root against, and I root for teams too, but I root for a lot of different teams for different reasons. But no, I think that's right. I think that fans are more educated now. They read more accurate analysis. So if you have a 65 win team on paper, you're going to know that going into the season. And it isn't like it used to be when you'd go into spring training thinking this might be the year. And the fact is, it's still true. It still might be the year. The unpredictable things still happen every season. But I think that the optimism that was once there every off season or every spring, that a lot of that has disappeared, and that hurts teams on the attendance side, no question. We saw attendance fall this season by, I think it was 3 or 4%, or I should say last season, and it seems to, the biggest reason seems to be the biggest drops came where teams just weren't going, looked like they weren't going to compete, and it started in the beginning of the season. Now, fans are also responsive to in-season performance, so things can certainly pick up if a team is playing better than it was expected to play, and vice versa. So you can't blame it just on people having a greater understanding of a team's true quality. But I think that does play into it. When I talk about the game being less entertaining, though, I tend to focus less on individual teams, although that's fair too, but and more on just what the game has turned into with its emphasis on strikeouts and home runs. And for me personally, that game isn't as entertaining as one with fewer of those things and more of everything else. Great double plays, runners going first to third on a single to right field, stolen bases, the list goes on and on. Everything, almost everything is going away except for what I call the two true outcomes, home runs and strikeouts.
That's a fair point, and that's also very topical here in New York. So the Mets fired their hitting coach, and one of the things they talked about was that they wanted to bring someone in who can adjust or maybe adjust where the – instead of pigeonholing every hitter into what particularly they – you know, what they want them to do, which like you said, home runs, launch angle, work with them to be the best, for lack of a better word, version of themselves as they can be. Now, we have a kid here named Jeff McNeil who comes up, and, you know, who knows what he'll turn out to be. You know, he was hitting for contact, spraying the ball around the field. He has a little bit of power, and it kind of revived a little bit of the fan base. Say, hey, maybe, you know, you don't have to have Dave Kingman at every position. Dave Kingman would be a better player today maybe than when he was actually playing. So Moneyball, to my opinion, always was misrepresented. It wasn't just about using stats over human. It was about finding the market inefficiencies. If everybody is going towards launch angle and finding a certain way to win or pigeonholing a certain way to win or a certain way to hit, the pioneer then or the team that's smart will say, hey, how do we diversify? I'm not saying bring back the 85 Cardinals, but look at the Royals from just a couple of years ago. They beat the Mets. That was not a home run laden team. They just kept coming and making contact and against pitchers that have a lot of swings and misses like Syndergaard and Harvey at the time and DeGrom, they were relentless and they had those kind of players. So, you know, maybe that's the next phase here, you know, continue to use smarts and common sense to say, everyone's doing it this way. Let me shift gears a little bit.
Well, certainly that's the ideal. The ideal is to have the power, but not give up on batting average and contact. And when the Astros won in 2017, they very nearly led the league in home runs, and they had a fine batting average, and they cut their strikeouts way, way down from the season before. So sure, every team should be working toward that. I think it is, it's not clear to me that you can win these days without hitting at least a fair number of home runs. because you've got to do something. You're still going to strike. Even the teams that don't strike out, they still strike out a ton. They're just not striking out relative to the other teams. The Astros strikeout totals in 2017 were very low compared to the league, but they were very high compared to 20 years earlier. So that's the tricky part. But clearly, yes, there isn't a competitive advantage to be found if you can strike out less often. You don't want to – saying strikeouts are irrelevant, it's just not true. You can live with them, but you'd rather not have to. And so certainly you want to hit for greater contact as long as you can keep most of the power. I also think that you're right. There might be a competitive advantage in finding some players who can place hit, who can bunt, who can do what Brett Butler did, get on base 40% of the time. There's something to be said for that, too. I think the counter argument is that it seems that literally nobody is trying to do that. You just don't hear about teams training their hitters to beat the shift with bunts or ground balls, line drives the opposite way. Maybe there's something there. It just seems like somebody would have been actively looking for it. And maybe they are behind the scenes and we don't know about it. But that's I wonder if the game, because the pitchers are throwing so hard and so well, I wonder if the game is structurally set up to defeat hitters who don't swing real hard almost every time, who don't go for home runs. And I wonder and argue in the book, I think, a little bit that maybe the game needs to be changed. The rules need to change to allow for players like that to thrive once again, because I'm not sure that they can thrive now.
That's an interesting point. Are we at the time similar, and here's an analogy, the NFL and the NBA have made adjustments for offense. The NFL, you really can't touch anybody anymore. The NBA, look, grew up a Knicks fan, love hardcore 90s defense. It was great. It was fun. I know the league looked at it and said, I can't have games that are in the 70s and televise it. They changed the rules. And I guess where you're going is baseball's never really changed the rules. They've never done what the NBA and the NFL and the NHL with the neutral zone trap had to do. So you're suggesting that maybe they have – and this is going to be tough because this league is not progressive in that sense. And the fan base, the loyal fan base, it will be tough. It will be tough for me to accept. But are we at the point like the NBA was in the 90s where we're like, we can't continue to allow this? It's destroying the game.
I wouldn't use the word destroying because the money keeps going up. The revenues continue to increase year to year, even as attendance goes down. MLB just got a lovely new contract extension from Fox. I think the money went up by like 50% through 2020. I think it's 2028. So, no, the game's not in any danger of collapsing. But I think in the long term, the trends that we see it statistically are not encouraging, not in terms of revenue, but certainly in terms of attendance, and certainly in terms of just what the numbers look like with the strikeouts and all the home runs. Now, it might be that a critical mass of fans actually wants even more home runs, even more strikeouts. I don't think anybody knows, but I have to push back a little against the notion that baseball has never done anything, because historically baseball has done plenty of things. Most famously, the mound was lowered in 1969 after the year of the pitcher. Many other times the strike zone has been adjusted. The baseball has been played around with, not in recent decades, not that we know about anyway, for sure, but back in the 30 years of the 20th century, 30 or 40 years, the ball was messed with all the time to make it more lively or less lively, almost purely with the intention of making the game more entertaining. So it's not until recently that the rules, and in particular the strike zone and the baseball, were considered sacrosanct, and we can't mess with anything. Well, that's a fairly recent development, and in my opinion, it's largely due to the power of the Players Association. In 1969, if baseball wants to lower the mound, they just lower the mound. They have a meeting in November or December, whenever it was, and they say, you know what? Last year it wasn't working. This year of the pitcher, we can't have that again. We're going to drop the height of the mound by 3 inches or 5 inches. And they did it, and it worked. You just can't do that anymore because of the Players Association. And that's why baseball hasn't been responsive to these trends that we've seen. They just don't want to get into a massive fight with the players. But I think ultimately, if the game is going to get back to some reasonable variety of on-field events, you've got to do something.
Rob Nyer with me. A couple more before we wrap up. And by the way, if you're reading the book Powerball, you haven't read it, you should read it, because like how we're talking is kind of how the book, in my opinion, at least flows. Rob, managers, you know, A.J. Hinch, Bob Melvin, I guess those are two managers in the book of the game you watched. You know, here, you know, I think back, you have Lou Piniella back in the day, and Billy Martin, and Bobby Valentine, and even Joe Torre, even though he was a different type of personality. The manager was the personality, and we've been told in some instances they don't matter. I think there's a misunderstanding. Some of the fans think the front office sits with a button. Like I'm a Strat-O-Matic baseball fan. This isn't Strat-O-Matic baseball yet, okay, where you sit at your house hitting buttons. But has the manager – we know he's changed with the demeanor and the way he has to handle a new generation of players, but – are we at a point where is it fair to say that, you know, they're just there executing a script? I think that's a little bit of a narrative from the anti-analytics crowd. What about the managers as you watch this game and as you've watched the sport evolve? Are we undervaluing them now?
I think that managers still get a fair amount of play. I do think that there was a period of time, and I don't think it's still true today, but there was a period of time when there was a reaction against the idea that managers were everything. Because, you know, the idea that with a few exceptions, the idea that managers were making a huge difference season to season just, I think, wasn't true. I think they were overrated. At least by a fair percentage of fans and writers. And I think we sort of overreacted against that overrating. And I'm sure if you went back to 1996 or 7 or something, you could find something I wrote for ESPN.com saying managers were irrelevant, and or at least their in-game moves were largely irrelevant. We've come back a little bit from that. I think we've gotten – in many ways, once we sort of won the big battle, you know, the battle for the relevance of analytics, we were able to come back and say, oh, you know what? I think maybe I was a little bit too hasty to say managers aren't that important, or pitch framing isn't that important, et cetera. There are a lot of things like that. I do think that we have a more realistic appraisal of what managers do now. We understand that much of their value comes in not the tactical maneuvers made during the games, but comes off the field, in the clubhouse, how they deal with players. But these aren't really secrets. I mean, Bill James was writing that sort of thing 35, 40 years ago, that the manager's job, one of his maybe his biggest job is keeping all the players, or almost all of them, pulling on the same end of the rope for 6 months. That's a tough thing. And it might be you'd rather have a guy who is good at that, and maybe that's Dusty Baker, for example, than a guy who's not good at that but really good at the tactical stuff. I don't think anybody gives Dusty Baker great marks for his pitching changes, et cetera. But he seems to have done, wherever he's been, a great job of managing the clubhouse and keeping everybody on the same page for a whole season. So I think we're more realistic. Managers do make more money than they've ever made before, but they're still not paid a lot. You look at Joey Cora, he's paid nothing. He's paid roughly the same salary you give the 24th, 25th man on your roster. So it's still not clear how much value teams think managers have, you know, with the exception of someone like Joe Maddon, who's sort of a superstar manager to the extent that we have those anymore. It's still not clear that teams even believe these guys make a huge difference with the way they pay them and the way they fire them after a bad season or two. So we're still trying to figure out what those guys mean, and their roles are changing. They have more help than they've ever had before. I think the biggest thing now is they have to show willingness to work with the front office and work with the analytics people. To come up with game plans and all the rest. And if you don't do that, you're going to have a tough time getting a job these days.
Yeah, it's almost like football. You know, you have a game plan going in. That's right. You know, last thing before I have you talk about what's coming up for you and some of the things you got going on is bullpenning and the changing of how we start the game, manage the bullpen, which in my opinion is the biggest thing a field manager can do, whether they do it before the game or during the game. Is that the 2019 trend or the new inefficiency that everyone's trying to, you know, figure out? In your opinion, is it that, or is there something else in 2019 that data analysis, progressive minds in the game will come up with, which will be the hot topic out there?
No, I think that is going to be the story in 2019. I think that we saw the Rays use it a great deal successfully. And then a few other teams dabbled over the course of the season. Even the Dodgers, you know, you'd think, oh, the Rays, that makes sense, right? They don't have any money. They have to scrimp and save and find whatever little edge they can. But the Dodgers don't have to worry about money, but they did it too, because it turns out, I think teams are realizing, or at least believing, I think they're right, but I could be wrong, is that it doesn't make any sense to shove pitchers into this box, starting pitcher, this box that requires the pitcher to give you five or six or ideally seven or eight innings. Very few teams have five guys like that who can give you those innings and be good. The Dodgers at times, with all their money, all their resources, didn't have five. They had three or four. So they found the other way. And I think that we're only going to see more and more of that. I will be surprised, and I'm happy to be surprised, but I'll be surprised if bullpenning doesn't explode in 2019, as more and more teams look at their roster and say, oh, wow, we only have three guys like that. Okay, well, this is what we'll do on the other 2 days. So, yes, I think that's going to be the story. It gets back to what we talked about before. I'm not sure that's great for the game or for the fans. I think it means, you know, means more pitching changes. It means more sort of anonymous players. And, frankly, I would love to see a rule limiting the number of pitchers you can carry on the roster. I think that the game has become less interesting with 12 or 13 pitchers than it was with 10 or 11. But again, you're going to have a tough time getting that past the Players Association, any sort of roster limits. So we'll see. But I do think that's definitely we're going to see a great deal more of that next year than we saw this year.
Listen, economically, if bullpenning becomes the trend, it's going to kill the Players Association, because if you're not going to pay starters big money, and I know relievers, their salaries are going up, but you're almost it's almost economic socialism from a pitcher, where everybody might make the same money, because what's the value of a Noah Syndergaard if he's only going to go four innings and Seth Lugo is going to go three innings? And almost you're going to start to say, well, they're the same. You know, that may be the straw that broke the camel's back and get the limits that you talk about. You know,
possibly. That's an interesting point. I do think that Syndergaard will still be expected to give you six or seven. I think that there will just be starting pitchers. Nobody's ever going to ask Justin Verlander, I don't think, to go three or four innings. But there aren't that many guys like that. It's a good point. I think that we're already seeing this. Relief pitchers become more and more fungible, where you've got, at least on a standard pitching staff, seven relief pitchers on the roster for a given game. But frankly, there are another five or six back in AAA who are seen as nearly as good as most of the guys in the major league bullpen. And you see this happen all the time. Pitchers come up, they're there for a day or two. They pitch, maybe they don't pitch, then they go back down. Most relief pitchers are now seen as essentially interchangeable. So why would you pay those guys a lot of money? Why wouldn't you pay them the major league minimum? But I don't think you're going to see any real impetus for change from the Players Association unless or until the players' share of revenues drops significantly, which it actually hasn't yet. It's still close to 50%. If you go down into the mid-40s, then you're going to have some issues, and the players are going to be looking for changes. Now, that just might mean mandating how much money they get every year, or it could mean roster changes. I'm not sure. But you're absolutely right. There's no reason for teams to pay a lot of money to pitchers who are giving them pitching 30 or 40 or 50 innings a year. It doesn't make any sense.
So the book is Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. Harper is the publisher. Rob Nyer is the author. Rob, I know you're the commissioner of a Cape Cod type league out on the West Coast. This is your seventh book. I know that you've written for ESPN and SB Nation and Fox. So what else do you have coming up? Obviously the book. What else can you let the listeners know about? Especially if a bunch of them are fans of your work over the years, that you can let us know about what you got going on through the holidays.
Well, I appreciate that. I really, honestly, I should today. As we speak, I am fantasizing about starting my next book, or at least writing the proposal for my next book, which might not sell, but I am pretty excited about a project. I can't quite talk about it yet because it's just still so early. I think once I sell the book, if I sell it, then I can start saying, I'm working on this book and I need some help. What do you guys think about this? I really hope that that process is about a month or two away. So I'm focusing on that. And the being commissioner of the West Coast League, it looks like I probably will do again next season. And it can take up as much time as I want it to. There's no end to what a commissioner can do. It's a question of how much time I have. But that's been just a great deal of fun. Last season, I got to do all the things that all these things I never thought I'd get to do. I got to throw out first pitches at games. I got to wear a mascot's costume for an inning. I got to hand out the championship trophy at the end of the season. Visit all the ballparks, ranging from Kelowna and Victoria up in British Columbia down to Corvallis and Bend in Oregon, and it was just a fantastic summer, and I'm really looking forward to another great season.
Well, I wish I would have saw Bud Selig in a mascot costume. That would have been interesting.
Well, by the way, speaking of Bud Selig, the other thing that's it looks like my name's actually going to be on the baseball next season, which is another one of those things where you never think you'll get
very
to do
cool.
Something like that. But
you got to put up on your man. I don't know if you collect career trophies, but if I were you, I'd put that one up on the mantle. That's pretty
cool. I'm fairly sure I will save one baseball for myself, yes.
right. Listen, have a great Thanksgiving. Have a great holiday. It's been a long time. I've been meaning to catch up with you. I really appreciate you. You were very generous with your time. Be well, and let's do this again. All right, my friend?
Oh, Mike, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
You bet. Anytime.
That's Rob Nyer, ESPN. As I told you, that was a pretty fun story. He was always very, very good to me at a time when I wasn't considered. I was like the pirate coming into the penthouse. Let's put it that way. Hey, let's take a quick break. When we wrap up, I know that was a long segment. Just a thought as we were talking to Rob about how bullpenning and how the Mets could implement that. I'll go through that really quick. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. I'm your host, Mike Silva. We'll be back with some more Talking Mets right after this.
Well, here's some data for you in talking about these pitching usage ideas. The last three postseasons, when a starter goes six or more, the team is 45-24. When a starter goes less than six, the team is 42-63. So almost mirror images of one another.
Could you read that one more time? Because I think there's some people watching the game that will not really understand what you just said.
I will.
Oh, no. I heard you, fellas. I heard you. That was last night. I'm sitting home minding my own business. Matt Viskers and John Smoltz are good pals on Fox, waging the war on bullpenning. Realize, of course, that's a classic case of correlation, not causation. Meaning in this era, pitchers who were kept in a game at least six innings are the ones who are having a successful outing. It's not that teams are winning because they are letting pitchers go six innings. But let's play it out. Maybe we can learn something. Listen in.
I'll give it to you in terms of winning percentage. Starter goes six innings or more, 652 winning percentage.
That's pretty good, right?
Starter goes less than six, 400 winning percentage.
That's not good unless you're talking about a batting game.
Correct. So think about it in terms of the Yankees, right? This was supposed to be a Yankee staff that was going to piecemeal together each game of the postseason because their starters didn't go as deep as some of the other postseason teams. That guy goes seven.
Yep.
That guy goes seven. They win both of those games. Sabathia's rolling tonight, and they're in pretty good shape.
That's how you do it.
Don't get cute. Feed your horses. Let them eat.
And use your eyes.
Oh, goodness. They unloaded the magazine there. Look, I love these guys, but the problem is they're on national TV. People are sitting home. They haven't studied this, and it sounds like they're making sense. But let's start by going back in time. A time when things maybe made sense to John Smoltz and Matty V. 2005, the AL Championship Series. Every single White Sox pitcher got into the ninth inning. Four of the five pitched a complete game. Contreras, Burley, Garland, Garcia. Later in a World Series sweep, all four went seven full innings. Their manager, Ozzie Guillen, stayed with his starters, and I've always applauded him for that. It's what made sense at that time. If your starter is dealing and he's not laboring, by all means, ride it out. The fact is, though, that's not how it normally works. Here's how it works now in modern baseball. The more a hitter sees a pitcher, the more success he has. Second time through the order, on base and slugging jumps. Third time through the order, both go up again. To the point where a hitter in 2017, on average, is slugging a very healthy .462. Now look at what a hitter does in 2017 the first time he faces a relief pitcher. The on base goes down 17 points, slugging goes down 62 points. It's enormous. So digest that. On the whole, not for every single pitcher, but by and large, a hitter facing a starter the third time in the order turns into an all-star. A guy slugging .462 is all-star level. That's what Buster Posey and Adam Jones slugged this year, just to give you an idea. So manage our wise now to avoid that. Not only that, there are more flame-throwing arms to use than ever before. The Yankees just showed this in the wild card game when their bullpen went 8 2/3, giving up just one run, beating the Twins. The bullpen had 13 strikeouts. When you acquire or develop six good arms in the bullpen the way the Yankees have, you basically have covered nine innings. So a starting pitcher is a relic of an ancient time. So this is not just the Yankees, it's all throughout baseball. Take a look at how many excellent relievers there are now in the game. I set the bar at a sub-3 ERA and better than a strikeout per inning. All right, it's a start. It's a way of doing it. In 1967, there were two of them. 1987, there were five. 1997, 12. 2007, there were 22. This year, there were 42. 42 of those guys. I'm not saying pitching is better. I know strikeouts are at an all-time high anyway, and there's a lot of factors in that. But it's a fact. There are more lights-out, three-out pitchers than ever before. You can hope your starter goes six, and you can wish for the old days, or you can use several arms out of your bullpen and allow fewer runs. And that, by the way, is what is happening throughout baseball.
All right, we're back. Talking Mets podcast. And as I was listening to Rob Neyer, and that was a great conversation, by the way. I hope you enjoyed it. Really, maybe a little bit of an egghead. The two of us talking about baseball, like a couple of baseball wonks, I guess is the word I would use. But I thought he gave you a lot of things to chew on. And that's the book. The book is really, he's talking about the, you know, baseball topics while he's watching a game. Similar where if Rob and I were sitting there watching that A's Astros game, talking about those topics and things happen during the game that bring certain scenarios up and what have you. So I hope you enjoyed it. Definitely was topical with the DeGrom Cy Young, and I've been meaning to get him on, and that's been a lot of fun. So, you know, check out the book, Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game by Rob Neyer at Rob Neyer on Twitter. Give him a follow if you're not already. As far as bullpenning, so if that's the big topic in 2019, real quick, let's just dive into that. How can that play into the 2019 Mets being a more competitive, better team? And for a team that, let's presume, they're not going to trade any of their top four starters, DeGrom, Wheeler, Syndergaard, Mats, do you really need to bullpen with this team? And the question really is, can you get more certainty out of the bullpen by pushing the starters back? What I mean is this. You don't know when you're going to need a Seth Lugo. You don't know when you're going to need your closer, whoever they sign. You kind of have the starter start. You play it out. You play the game late matchups, and you try to get to the point. And this year, for the most part, after Familia, he got, you know, short injury, and then he was traded. It was Gesellman and Lugo closing things out for the most part, and you had a little bit of Drew Smith, a little bit of Tim Peterson, a little bit of Daniel Zamora. You had some of the young, you know, pitchers that they're trying to get a look at, the pitchers they acquired when they were out of the race back in 2017. So how do you get some certainty? What do I mean by that? What if you were to say, okay, Seth Lugo, in a seven-day week, you're probably going to play 5 to 6 games. Do you want to not pitch him more than 3 times? So maybe you make him the starter 3 times. You know, maybe he's the Friday starter, the Wednesday starter, the Monday starter. So, you know, basically gets a day off in between, and you max him out at so many pitches in an inning. You max him out at maybe 2-3 innings, and then your DeGrom, your Syndergaard, your Mats comes in the 4th inning, and conceivably you could then go and pitch him the rest of the game, because if they pitch 6 innings and you would want to get 6 to 7 innings out of guys like DeGrom and Syndergaard, you're going to be pushing them to the high leverage 7, 8, 9 innings, where normally you'd have to rely on maybe lefty ready matchups. You know, maybe if your top relievers are tired, you're going with some B level relievers. It is something interesting. Now, what really the question is, and I believe Kevin Rosenthal had wrote a piece about this at The Athletic late in the season, where the bullpenning, the uncertainty of when the quote-unquote opener was going to start, may have been messing around a little bit psychologically with some of the members of the A's pitching staff. I think the only way the bullpenning works, and the Mets have this weapon in Lugo, who's really so valuable in the bullpen, but you could also make an argument you want him as a starter. Maybe you use him in that hybrid role, and if you go out and you sign, let's say, an Andrew Miller, maybe he could be part of that. Maybe Gesellman is better in that scenario where you start him out the first, second, third inning. Now, psychologically, you know, you could lose that game if you're not on top of it. You could give up 3 runs in the first inning and you take, you know, DeGrom out of it, let's say. By the time he gets in the second or third inning, the game's maybe over, you know, especially if you're against a top pitcher like a Max Scherzer or an Aaron Nola, the guys that we mentioned earlier. But it would be very interesting. It would bring some certainty. You would maybe be able to manage your bullpen without burning them out. You're acknowledging that even with this dominant starting rotation, that you probably get the best out of them through 6 or maybe 7 innings, and you manage the game from the front rather than the back. Now, I don't have data at a high level. I don't know what Mickey Callaway's thinking. I don't know what any of these guys are thinking. All I know is that you need to improve the bullpen. And look, Jason Vargas is another guy. Maybe you only let Vargas go through the lineup 2 times. And you say, okay, you're going to be the opener these days. Can you go on, you know, 1 or 2 days rest a couple of times a week? It really would depend. Now, Lugo, you know, can do it because Lugo, for the most part, was a reliever all year. And you want to, there was that game against the Orioles where he kind of played as an opener when they needed a starter. What do you go, 4 innings? So, you know, I really think it's something, as much as I'm a traditionalist, and I think good starting pitching the traditional way, going seven, pushing these guys to eight innings is the way to go. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think the biggest part of this that you really have to take seriously is, you know, routine. How does this impact the routine of all these guys, including guys who are the openers like Lugo and or Vargas or a Gazelman, guys like that? You know, can they handle the difference? Is there a different routine for a DeGrom warming up in between the third and fourth inning as he's preparing to come in? Will it change his whole routine? Will it change his mindset sitting the first three innings? You're asking these guys to completely do something different. And yes, they're not Strat-O-Matic cards. They're not robots. They're not EA Sports players. They're humans who are used to preparing, pregame meal, national anthem, getting warmed up. There's a lot to be said for that. So a little bit of an interesting thing to think about. So if bullpenning, according to Rob Nyer, if that's the big topic of 2019, how can that play into the Mets' favor? That's just some thoughts that I have. Hey, I want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. I hope you enjoyed the show. I know a little bit of a longer segment, Rob, but I thought it was well worth it. We'll be back with more Talking Mets podcast as we head after the holidays. Of course, if some news breaks, we'll jump in. We'll be there. But maybe the league will take a little bit of a hiatus for the long weekend. So I hope you and your family have a great long Thanksgiving holiday weekend. Of course, if you want to check out Rob, you can check him out on Twitter at Rob Nyer and check out the book Powerball, Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. Check me out on iTunes. Check out the replay on iTunes. Leave me a review. Really appreciate it. Be well, everybody.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.